everyone, and good evening, and welcome to our Monday live show. And thank you all so much for being here. I think this is one of those rare ones, I suppose. We're streaming it to Facebook, to YouTube, to Rumble, to Getter, to the Twatters. We're almost across the universe, actually. So hopefully, wherever you are anyway, I hope you'll enjoy this one. We've got a fascinating conversation coming up. But before we get to that, just a couple of orders of business to get through. First of all, before we do it and say anything more, I just wanted to say that my thanks to everybody for all the kind wishes. I put up a post on Twitter earlier this morning just to say that my fourth grandchild arrived late last night, baby Luke, and that's a very proud moment, obviously, for any grandparent. And so we were visiting Luke this afternoon. Yes, Chris Davies, I am indeed definitely a grandpa, definitely. Doing my bit to keep the UK fertility rate levels up. But anyway, it's very, very, so I went in to see this, this tiny little infant, you know, less than 24 hours old. So, but a thank you to everybody for all your very kind wishes. I'm overwhelmed by all the stuff that you send me. Thank you all very much for that. So that's first thing. Second thing, I wanted to say to you was that we, as you know, we've done a live event in London back in December with Andrew Bridgen MP, Carl Benjamin, and then we did one in March with Lawrence Fox and with Father Calvin Robinson. And the next one will definitely be in London on the 26th of July. And I'm not telling you who the special guests will be just yet. You're going to get a lot of information very, very shortly. And I can assure you, you'll definitely have heard of our guests. And, you know, I'll not say much more than that at this point. I'm just teasing you with this one. But look, ring it in your diary and come along on that. Thanks, David McCollum. In fact, actually, David McCollum, but you stay there for a second. Yeah, thanks, everyone, Leslie. Again, thank you all so very much. Right. So anyway, look, that all having been said, let's play the ad from our sponsors, who also will be sponsoring the live event in London. And then we're going to bring our special guest in. So play ad.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jane Smith. Find your path by doing my new Millionaire's Mindset Hypnosis. I help you to break any subconscious thought patterns that are stopping you from obtaining all of your goals. The truth will then come to the forefront of your mind that you are worthy and deserving of achieving everything. You'll start to attract the right people into your life. Opportunities will open up as a result. Financial success is a natural outcome from being clear and focused. Everything will literally fall into place when you do what you love. People are already enjoying mind-blowing success with this incredible session. So what are you waiting for?
There we go, Quantum Hypno, link below, do check it out. You know, in this world of alternative media, as I always tell you guys, we don't have, you know, the billions that the BBC gets. We have to find, you know, our support from wherever we can get it. And Quantum Hypno are kind enough to sponsor me. And thank you to those of you who also buy me a coffee, link below if you want to do that as well. Okay, that's all that bit out of the way. Now, he's been fiendishly working in the background trying to get his lighting right. So we're going to bring on a guy who I think you'll really enjoy meeting. And in fact, let's bring him in and then we'll talk about things. Please, welcome to Peter Willoughby. Peter, hi. Peter, good evening.
Hey, good evening, David. Thank you for the invitation. I hope my lighting's a bit better than what it was before.
Actually. Yeah, we can definitely see it. We can definitely see it. You've got a slight shroud of mystery about you, Peter, but that's okay because, you know, as I say, the main thing is we can see you, we can hear you. It's all good. Now,
excellent. Now, Peter, thank you.
This, this is the first time you and I actually have been speaking to each other. But of course, we have a mutual friend who I think is watching this. I can see him in the background there. And that is Mr. David McCollum, who viewers of this platform are very well familiar with. David's been on with me several times, Peter. And in fact, actually, he was on a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about health, which is one of our, obviously, David, with his whole, all the work that he does in the health arena. And we were chatting about parasites, which actually was a really well-received broadcast. It was fascinating to see so many people getting into that. And we'll talk about health, Peter, and a lot on this one with you as well, because I think, generally speaking, I mean, we've all been through a big journey over the past, certainly 4 years, but your journey in health kind of goes back a bit before that. Now, I'm aware of your backstory, but I guess probably most people watching won't be. So perhaps talk us through basically, you know, what happened to you when you were a young man in terms of the accident?
Oh, David, thank you. And again, good evening to everybody that's listening. And again, thank you for having me on your show. It's a long story. Let's hope I'm not going to be too, too boring with this or too staid. So pull me up if I am. And give me a wrap round the knuckles if you need to speak a little bit.
Crack on, yeah.
But it's one of these events that that nobody should ever have in their life. You don't wish it upon anybody. I was a young, fit lad, you know, strong guy as I thought I was, doing everything that a young teenager would do at the age of 17. British Airways had just accepted me on a pilot training scholarship. So, you know, my dream job of flying aeroplanes was in my sight. Started with British Airways, 6 months in, I got run over. I had a head-on collision with a lorry. Mm-hmm. I was on a motorbike. And needless to say, it was that horrific that I was put in a hospital bed in intensive care, and I was in a coma for over a week. And the easiest way to explain, and I will say my initial problems at the time, is that everything was broken except for my right arm and my spine. So, you know, fractured skull, my face was kind of torn off, teeth were broken, hips, knees, ribs, ankles, tibia, fibia, all of the necessary bits and pieces that what we call our bones in our body. Virtually everything was broken. So All I can remember, and I'll leave it at this part and let you drill me further, was when I regained consciousness in a hospital bed. Unbeknown to me, I was on life support. I was in intensive care, and all I can remember was forcing to open my eyelids, and I just about opened one eye, and it was really, really quite, you know, an intensive light that was coming in. Now, because it was dripping, and I didn't know where I was. I didn't know whether I was in a dream or a deep sleep. I didn't know what had happened. Mm. And this little drip was just a bit of blood that was dripping where I'd torn my eyelid once again. But I could manage to, you know, to see through one eye. You know, the nurse came around, the doctors came around to say, you know, this guy is now conscious. It was really quite surreal. I woke up. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know, you know, really who I was. I couldn't remember that the last thing that I was doing was, you know, riding my motorbike just to go home from a friend's house. So that really was when I, you know, woke up after this accident, David.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, sort of head-on collision with a lorry on a motorbike.
Yep.
Very, very traumatic physical contact, as you say. So, I mean, I only can guess what the level of pain. What did you feel? Intense pain?
I'll say this in the nicest possible way for everyone, you know, listening. I was trussed up like the traditional Christmas turkey. My neck was in a brace being lifted up by what they call traction, the old-fashioned weights and pulleys. Both my legs were in pulleys. My arm was up here. I was a total mess. And in those earlier days when I just literally regained consciousness, I didn't feel much in the way of pain. My body was numb. My mind was numb. It was almost as though I was on a cloud. Mm. And that's due to the drugs that I was being administered by the hospital. Yeah. And it was just after probably 4 or 5 days, 4 or 5 days a week, once they stopped putting the what they were classed as the hard stuff into me, I started feeling the pain, you know. Was my whole body was just, you know, in agony, I think is the term.
Yeah, because I mean, as you said, you were a young fit guy, and you know, and then just suddenly bang, and you've just lost, you've lost all of that. I mean, you're like a trussed turkey, as you say, in a hospital bed. And at what point did you start to recognize what actually had happened to you, and where did that lead you?
It was probably about 2 or 3 weeks in. During that initial stage, I was quite numb. I was being told that, "Oh, tomorrow we're going to take you to theatre for this operation, and if that one is successful, you know, 2 days later there will be another operation." And it was probably after probably 2 or 3 weeks that I started to realise that, oh, you know, I've got another operation planned, and if that one works, and it started to correlate in my mind that, yes, I'm in a lot of pain. Yes, I've got a lot of problems. I've got these pieces of metal sticking out of both of my legs for the traction. When will they go? I can't move. I can't do anything. You know, and I've got to say this. You know, God bless the doctors and nurses of these hospitals. I mean, the nurses especially, because these poor, you know, guys and girls, they'd have to lift me up on the bedpan for me to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So, you know, my respect for what was around me was just, and is today, so immense. Mm. But it really wasn't, probably, I'm getting on for three, four weeks before I really started to correlate what was happening in my life. I thought, if I'm brutally honest, David, I thought, give me a few more painkillers, a couple of more operations, and I'll be walking out of here in a couple of weeks' time. And that was my, you know, I'm a big, strong guy. I'm going to do this. But that wasn't the case, unfortunately.
So tell us then. So how did things develop then from this pretty traumatic point?
It was frustratingly slowly. I had a complete sequence of operations planned. And I mean, if we take just one piece, for example, my right leg, I had paralysis in my legs and still do today. But, you know, do you fix the right hip, and the right femur had actually exploded? Do you fix those before you fix the bottom part? Because if the bottom part has a problem, and it was a big issue and it was a problem, they may have to take that piece off. So there's no point in fixing all the other bits if they've got to take your leg off from above the knee.
Yeah.
So there were little traumatic things like this. And, you know, you're almost numb. Your mind was numb, but it was starting to process these issues. And it started to sink in that, well, actually, I do have a bit of a problem here. And, you know, how am I going to cope with this? So, you know, it really was. It was one of these scenarios where I think psychologically, and I'll say this if I may, there was a chap in the bed next to me. I remember his name. I remember it to the day. He had a broken leg. You know, the bottom part of his leg was broken. The top part was broken. And I think he had a broken arm. And in my book, that was quite trivial, quite basic. And I remember speaking to him, and his name was Stephen. I won't give his last name out. I said, "Steve, how's it going today?" And he would turn around and say, "Pete, I'm so much pain. This hurts, that hurts, everything hurts." And he was constantly, you know, I think mentally, on a downward spiral.
Yeah.
He was almost talking himself into a huge problem. And I spoke to him this one particular day, and bearing in mind I'm really totally and absolutely trussed up like a turkey. And that was it. He just passed away. He just left us.
God.
And you know, I remember pressing my little button, you know, calling the nurse and saying, nurse, Steve's not talking. I think there's a problem. Yeah. And I tell you how naive I was to it, David. I say this, you know, never in a humorous way, but I said to the nurse, I said, you know, I hope it's not something I said. And chap just left me there and then.
Peter, you were 17. You know, at 17, what does any of us know about anything? Do you know what I mean? I mean, especially in such a traumatic environment as you found yourself. I mean, that's shocking. So the chap in the beside you basically passed away in front of you.
Yes, whilst talking to me. And it was, I even can't process that today.
Yeah.
And I think the big reason is because his injuries, I won't say pale insignificance compared to what I went through or what I had. Mm. But, you know, if I went 100%, he's on about 10% with his injuries.
Yeah.
And I just could not understand why. And I think now I look at that and think, well, actually, that in itself taught me a significant lesson in how to use the power of the mind.
Yes. Yes, well, that's exactly it, isn't it? I mean, you know, the most powerful organ we have is this one here, and it can make such a difference. So obviously, finding yourself in that position, Peter, and with all this damage done to your body, you then resolved to find a path to recovery.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I started to. I started to do the best I possibly could. You know, standing up was a problem. I was in a wheelchair for a significant amount of time.
Yeah.
But I wasn't one to give up. You know, I'd look out. I remember when I was in the hospital bed, when I first went in hospital, it was, you know, green outside. The leaves are on the trees. The sun was shining.
Yeah.
And I watched the leaves go brown. And I watched the leaves fall off. And then I watched the snow come. And I just thought, I'm missing out on this thing called life.
Yeah.
I need to be a part of what's going on outside that window. Mm. So the road to recovery was obviously very, very slow. But it was literally one step at a time. I remember the day that I stood up out of my wheelchair and I got onto a pair of crutches and I was very unstable. You know, my parents, who, God bless them, were no longer with us, but they were holding me up. You know, I had bits of, you know, scars and scabs on my knees and they started bleeding when I stood up. It was quite a sort of, my blood was coming out of my toenails. Very, very unusual circumstances. But again, I started to say, look, one step at a time. And that's what I started to do, was to fight forward, literally. As every day went by, I'd get up on my crutches and do a couple of steps.
Yeah. As you say, literally one step at a time in your case. Amazing. And so what was the progress like then? Obviously, initially, just standing up was a victory, I guess. And how did that then develop, Peter?
It was. Standing up was, I think, probably the biggest challenge. It's, unless you've been through it, when you've laid flat in a hospital bed for many weeks, you know, there's a lot of things in the body that actually stop to work. And I think one of the things that, and I won't go into my mother's, God bless her, challenges, but the doctors actually put her in a hospital bed and say she needs to stay in bed. And I'd argue, no, she doesn't. You know, she needs to be up. She needs to be mobile.
Yeah.
Because if you're confined to a bed, certainly for a few weeks, to get up afterwards is a whole new exercise all over again. It really is quite tough to do so. But, you know, being a young lad, and as you said quite rightly earlier on, you just don't know anything in life. You just think you can get up and go and do it. That's exactly what I programmed my mind to do. I set myself a goal. And whether it was two steps or, you know, then another four or then eight, I'd fight each day until, you know, I eventually got to the point where I was doing, you know, hundreds of meters outside of my parents' front door with them watching where I was going to make sure I didn't fall over. But it was a slow journey to recovery, but it taught you so much. You know, we can touch on that in a minute, but that whole that whole episode taught me and really flipped the way my brain thinks about many, many different things in life.
Yeah, because, in a way, although that was a really traumatic incident in your life and it happened at an early stage in your life, as you say, the upside to that is it flips things around inside. I mean, you basically have got, I suppose, in those set circumstances, two options. You just lie back and go under, a bit like your friend in the bed next to you, or you literally get yourself up and you get yourself going and you force yourself to go forward, which is obviously what you've done, Peter, throughout your life. But, you know, again, at that point, at 17, 18, I mean, that's what you call a life lesson with it, you know, on steroids, pardon the pun.
It is.
Yeah.
You think you're young, you're indestructible. You used to do gymnastics and swim and, you know, end up in the boxing ring at a young age. And you really do think you're totally indestructible, but obviously you're not. And I think the one thing that really taught me above all and above everything is, which is probably leaning on to where we are now, is I endured so many operations that I've lost count. I was actually asked to see how many, and I got into the high 30s. I don't quite know if I've had 40 operations or 35, but it's somewhere between 35 and 40. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of the this type of thing that I've endured that I really don't want to go through anymore. I like to feel that I've had my fair share.
Yeah.
But it focuses the mind, and what it says to you, it endorses the value of time, you know, the value of life, friendship, those around you. It really brings those qualities back home. And I think most importantly, and perhaps something we will step into, is health and well-being within that environment.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I know it's a bit of a truism, but health is very much wealth. And but we've all gone through a period in the past 4 years, Peter, since the COVID thing, COVID scam, as I would put it, comes in. But still been very traumatic. And a lot of people's views on health, I think, has dramatically changed. I mean, just give my own sort of normie experience. Up until that sort of point, I kind of just went along. You know, I went along trying to be sensible as much as you could be, but didn't think about, you know, oh, I have to go with everything the GP says. I have to go, you know, I don't really worry about big pharma. None of those things, right? But now that all changed. I mean, totally changed, totally dramatically. I'm down every rabbit hole you could imagine. And what I see is that at the core of all, you can talk about loads of stuff, right? But at the core of everything, I feel, if you're healthy, if you feel good, Peter, if you feel that you are the very best that you can be, you know, and bear in mind, none of us are superhumans, but if you can be the best that you can be, it's amazing what you can accomplish, isn't it? And it's a physical thing and it's a mental thing together. And that's been my big learning over the last, you know, four years or so. It's become very, very clear in my mind that our health is so important. It's one of the reasons I met David, our friend David McCollum. We met up at a freedom rally we were at together, and we became firm friends at that. And we recognized that, again, health is wealth.
It's our number one quality, isn't it? Our number one asset, which is where I think we should focus. Now, I'm going to pause because my screen's frozen with you.
Yeah, there was something happened there. Okay. Peter, don't worry about it. We're back on
and fighting.
So literally, I reckon health is wealth.
It is, David, because it doesn't matter who you speak to, but when people get into their later years, you know, the number one focus they've got is what is it we're doing with our time? You know, you've got to maximize every second of your time. And really, once I got out of that hospital bed, I got out of that wheelchair and I eventually got off of those crutches and onto these little things called walking sticks. The one thing that was embedded in my mind is that I cannot waste my time. No matter what I do in my life going forward now, and subliminally this was the case as well, whatever I'm doing, if I don't like it, if I don't want to do it, I just walk away from it. I've really got to enjoy where I'm sacrificing this precious asset called my time. I've got to be very cautious where I'm putting it. I ended up leaving British Airways. They did take care of me, but I went out temping, believe it or not. And if I didn't like the temp job where I was, I just said, hey, agency, please send me somewhere else. I don't like it here. But that was another story, in itself. But that whole focus took me to two things: the value of time. And I think another part that goes hand in hand with that is when you look at a thing called a job or a career, my view towards career changed. Is a career a good thing or a bad thing? I don't really know if it's good or bad, but all I know that it is, it's one of your routes, one of your pathways to retirement. If a career is a route to retirement, is that something I really want? Well, it depends what's on that path. I'd like to diversify and try something else. I used to look at that and say, well, a career is perhaps not something I'm really that interested in because I want variety. And the other thing was this thing about trading your time for money. Everyone trades time for money in general. You go to work, 9 till 5, and you've just exchanged your time for a bit of money that you get back. And in the back of my mind, this coin was always, flicking around saying, how can I not trade my time but still earn this dreaded energy called money, which I need to use to go forward in life? So those little things were playing in the back of my mind. But I think the real stinger came for me in the late 80s, where I'd had one of my last major operations and the consultant said, that's it, everything you've got is finished now. We've done your knees, hips, ankles, elbow, ribs, everything. You've had it all done. The only thing you're likely to have in the future is maybe a couple of knees replaced and maybe a couple of hip replacements. So be prepared for that. And he then actually said something that just totally knocked me sideways. He said, well, really, you're as good as you're going to get at this point in time. From now, it's a slow journey downhill. And you can imagine, this was the late 80s. So. Yeah. I've probably been out of my wheelchair for about 6 or 7 years, only to be told that I need to think about my future, about having a bungalow where I could have a wheelchair and I could widen the doors, I could put ramps in, and I could plan for my, my future, which would begin in my 30s, to be back in a wheelchair. And that was a sledgehammer.
Oh, yeah.
That was an absolute, that really was, it was real thump. So I then had to think about this fantastic word now, and this is something I love. It's called prevention. I wanted to prevent all of my problems from getting worse as quickly as what the doctors anticipated they would.
Yeah.
So I wanted to look at prevention. But that word prevention, as we touched on before, didn't just look at me. At the time, it was me physically, selfishly looking at me to prevent myself going back in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
But that has expanded my horizon, looking everything around, looking around us, looking, at all corners to say, in a simplistic way, what can I do to help prevent any future problems?
Absolutely. I mean, prevention is obviously the right strategy in all these matters, because if you can stop whatever the thing is affecting you, then that's a win. That's an absolute win. So what were the preventive strategies that you deployed, Peter?
Well, initially, naively, and I'm back to the late 80s, early 90s, I did whatever research I could. Internet wasn't around at that point in time, so it was down to the local library and reading books. I'm not the best of readers, but I did the best I could. And for my own personal perspective. I looked at what it was from a nutritional point of view, what the body required.
Yeah.
So I did start to, research, not to the extent of your, our mutual friend, young Mr. David McCullum. And I've got to say, David is an absolute, I've met a lot of people in the health and wellness industry, a lot of people in a whole raft of different industries connected with health. But, David's knowledge is just second to none. And David, I'm saying that in a very positive and supportive way. He really has been a great rock for me in many circumstances. So, health and nutrition is something I looked at. What it was I could do to help prevent, mainly arthritis.
Yeah.
So that was my first port of call. And it's not just about what you consume. It's also about what not to consume.
Yes, that's a good point.
And that really is, I say to a lot of people, it's sometimes it's better what you don't have than what you do have.
Right.
One of the early things that jumped out at me, dare I say, were these carbonated fizzy drinks without throwing any brand names into the mix.
Yes.
I learned very early on, just reading through a lot of articles that these, fizzy, sugar, carbonated drinks were just an absolute no-no. So I started stripping those out of my diet. And I started looking at, as you say, the more and the better produce that came from farms before they went into a factory, before foods got processed. So it's very basic, very down-to-earth, elements. And an area that we, perhaps can step onto in a few minutes, if you will, all during the time that I was, at home in a wheelchair on crutches, my mobility was very poor, very poor. As far as hobbies and interests were concerned, it was tough. But I started looking at what they term amateur radio or ham radio. And it's listening to everybody around the world. It was building transmitters, and I've got, there's a whole bunch of kit behind me that's all fired up for doing everything around the world. I became a licensed ham radio operator back in 83. And I really looked quite intensely at radio, radar, everything to do with communications, RF, EMF, everything, which stems right back to 83. That's 40 years.
So I remember all that, and I that was really the whole beginning of the whole amateur radio stuff. I remember having a summer job as a student back then. And some of the guys had these, the amateur radio comms stuff. And it seemed back then, this going back to the early 80s, it seemed like, gosh, this is the future. This is unbelievable tech. That was then. Now, look, as you said, the internet didn't come into the late 90s or whatever. So tech's changed. Us so much, hasn't it? Tech has totally changed us. And has it always been in a good way, Peter? That's the question.
Well, I say it's not actually, no. And one of the things that I learned very early on, and I will say this tongue in cheek, is I remember the CB operators. And I will confess, I did have CB. And this is something that kind of goes in line with perhaps where we're going to today. Is if you look at the old CB frequencies, there was the one that came over from America, which was a form of modulation called amplitude, AM. And then the UK decided to put its own specification in, which is another form called frequency modulation. I won't bore you with how the technology works. But they were both on above 27.5 megahertz. Now, if you multiply 27.5 by 3, you end up in the high 80s. Or towards the 80s. Now, if you had very poor quality transmitters, old CB transmitters, and you may laugh at this, remember this, Fannie Mae that lived across the road would hear you on her radio while you're pressing your microphone. and what you're actually doing is where you've got a poor quality transmitter that really isn't let's use the word clean. I'm being very, very simplistic here, and I think it's nice to be simplistic. If it's not a clean transmission, it's a spurious transmission. A transmitter of that era, and even today, will create what they call a harmonic.
Yes.
Now, a harmonic is a multiple of the frequency you're transmitting. So if it was 27.5, for example, if you go, you can go 2 times 27.5.
Yeah, I got you.
And then 3 times. And usually the third harmonic is what is recognized as, and I term it, a dirty harmonic. It's a very strong harmonic. And, you know, somebody that has a receiver nearby will hear that transmission. If we relate that to where we are today,
yes,
with some of the mobile phone technology, and you've got a mobile phone that isn't particularly perfection in its transmission qualities, if you take the 900 meg band, you times 900 by 3, you know, you're 2.7 gigs. So you're up into frequencies. That's a third harmonic. Sorry, I should explain that a bit better. That, you know, a bad transmitter would give out a third harmonic. And that third harmonic can be quite naughty. It's not very clean. And that's where people can actually get headaches. And likewise now, most of, and we're actually going a lot higher than this. We're going high up into the gigahertz bands. Now, you know, 1.8 gigs times that by 3. You're up into the microwave frequencies. Now, when you've got a third harmonic that's up into the microwave frequencies, if it's a poor quality phone, a higher power transmission, it will create this third harmonic. Now, as everybody knows, you know, energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It changes from one form to another. Mm-hmm. And what happens is with EMFs in particular, and there's a lot of talk about EMFs going around at the moment, is if you've got something that's heavy and dense and you're trying to pass a signal through it, and EMF surrounds all of us. It's been since radio was invented. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. But if it's quite a strong signal and a very high frequency, it creates, bluntly speaking, it creates friction, and friction creates heat.
Mm.
Now, that's why you can't put a metallic item in a microwave, because the RF or the EMF can't pass through a metallic item. And if you put, for example, and I don't have a microwave here, but if you put chicken in a microwave, that's why the bones will get hot before the rest of the chicken will, because they're a denser medium. Right. And for that RF or EMF, for that radio frequency to pass through it, it's harder. The bones create resistance, and resistance creates heat.
Mm-hmm.
Hence why they heat up. Mm-hmm. And if we go back, many years, we'll hear, you know, certainly when the mobile phones first came out, you know, we'd hear people, and even today we hear people saying, "Oh, you know, my ear feels hot, or my head feels a little bit hotter than normal, or I've got a bit of a headache." Anything that's dense, like your bone in your skull, will create friction, will create heat. So,
I vividly remember the early days of mobile phones, and I remember there was, like, concerned people, citizens. I remember going to a public hall meeting, and there was a lot of concern back then. This is the very early days about, well, what could the effect of these things be on our health? And I was, as I said, I was within a year or two of the things coming out, Peter, you know. So, do you think mobile phones are safe?
I think that there's a lot of factors that, you know, I would suggest that would, you know, determine whether they, I mean, are they safe? It depends on the quality of its components and how it's manufactured, as to how good it would be or how bad it would be as far as leaking its RF or EMF is concerned.
Yes.
Anything that transmits energy, you know, EMF. And you've got a question, is that EMF you're receiving an acceptable level or not? You know, mobile phones can be used safely. I mean, I like to use mine when I'm in the car because I Bluetooth it to the car.
Yeah, me too.
I'm surrounding myself in EMF, but I try to reduce that as best I can. You know, and I think because I've surrounded myself with RF all of my life, as far as my amateur radio is concerned, it's at such a low frequency and a low power. There's no detriment being shown. But it's once that resistance, that friction starts being shown that generates heat, I think is where we start getting into problems. So I would suggest people are using, you know, low quality phones. And I don't even know the real quality of, for example, the brands that we have, the Samsungs and the Apples. I don't know the quality of their components, how well they're put together. But, you know, my, you know, personally, I try and use it as least as I possibly can. If I do use it, I try and use it with a, you know, hands-free device in the car, and I do most of my conversations in the car. At home, and you'll love this about my home, this is where I'm getting a little bit in-depth now. I designed my house based around what they call a Faraday cage. I was blessed. In certain areas, I haven't been blessed, but I've been blessed that I was able to take my old house down and build a new house. And I built it on the principles of a Faraday cage. Now, a Faraday cage either contains EMF within it or it prevents it from getting in. So I designed the house to actually prevent outside EMF from coming into the house.
So you designed the house to act as a Faraday cage then to prevent EMF coming in. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
How did you do that then?
With great difficulty. Faraday cage is usually designed for a specific frequency range, and knowing what we have around us today is quite difficult to actually, along with the local council and along with the materials we have available to us, actually design something that is perfect for everything that we have around, you know, around us. But I put it together. And I've tested everywhere I can within the property, and it's done a very good job. And one of the critical things is it's about keeping EMF out. Thankfully, all of the insulation of today is foil backed. You know, there's a thing called Celotex. There's another one called Kingspan insulation. They're foil on the back and the front, so each panel, I've connected the foil together on every single panel throughout the house. And the big steel legs that go into the ground, earthed, that's critical, it's got to be earthed, is I've connected and bonded all of these insulation panels to the steel legs that go into the ground. So everywhere around me now, everything is earthed. So any RF outside, the only way it can come in is through the windows. And the one thing I've yet to do on this window is get a blind that contains aluminium mesh inside, because that would help reflect signals. As far as the internals of the house are concerned, this is something I would suggest to everybody. You know, if everyone's got an ADSL router with a Wi-Fi aerial, and everyone's buying these Wi-Fi boosters, switch them off at night. Is that easy? Just press the on-off switch on the power and turn the thing off. I've got a house here which the signals don't go through very well because it's very well taken care of. I hardwired the whole house for internet. Virtually in every room, I've got a hardwired cable. All my earthing sockets go off to earth, and I put a little. Just a little Wi-Fi box, if I choose to Wi-Fi. I'll plug it into the mains, plug the cable into the necessary port, and I use it on Wi-Fi. If people are around, we use it on Wi-Fi, and I switch it off when I'm finished with it. So, in effect, my house is Wi-Fi dead unless I decide to turn the switch on.
Yes, because you've hardwired the connection, the your internet connection around the house then, so it's not traveling by, because I think a lot of people, as you say, have got Wi-Fi boosters all over the. I mean, I live in a pretty solid house here, and again, you know, but I do have some hardwired stuff going on as well, not all of the house, but a fair bit of the house is hardwired. But I think a lot of people think, well, what's the problem with a Wi-Fi booster? They're really good. They're really popular. Everybody loves them. What's not to like about a Wi-Fi booster, Peter?
I would suggest some of them aren't very good quality, and they create a third harmonic once again. So you just got to look at the frequency they're chucking out and look at that third harmonic. It's not very powerful. And I must say the power isn't that huge. But if you can live without it or live with it only for a small period of time, then it's better than leaving it on all the time. I don't subscribe to having a complete environment filled with a Wi-Fi router, purely because if you were to take an RF meter, which is what you know we would call, into the property, you would see a whole myriad of frequencies. And the question is, how are those affecting your body?
Yes, you're dead right. I often wonder and worry about this. It's like the invisible world that is in all our houses. We can't see it, Peter, but we do know that it's there, and most of us probably can't measure it. But it's what is it doing to our, or what could it potentially be doing to our health and our well-being? That's really the big question.
And I think that is the one that is still out there for debate at the moment. I'll give you another classic here, David. This is just a bit of food for your listeners. Absolutely everything that is metallic is an antenna. Now, you've got a nice pair of glasses on. Your glasses, actually, they are an antenna for RF that's around you. I've got a body that's full of bits of metal, you know, pins, wires, some of the bigger stuff I've had taken out. So I've got bits of metal in me that are aerials for any form of RF. So any metallic item that anyone has is a receiver for the EMF. Irrespective of what frequency it is around you, it's going to say, hey, come to me, I'm your aerial. So, you know, and there are people today, and if we look at people's health today compared to what it was, you know, a decade ago, or even before a lot of the Wi-Fi started, you will find people aren't as tired or weren't as tired then as they are now. People are a lot more lethargic now. They feel a lot more burnt out now. Mm. They're not as, is crisp the right word? Now, is this down to the bad state of the food in our society, or is it down to the fact that we are being totally swamped with EMFs around us? Yeah. Is it bad air quality? There's so many factors that surround us with that.
I think probably the answer is it's probably a bit of all of the above, really, isn't it? It is like it's the food, it's the water, actually, never mind the food, the water. It's just so the weird thing is in 2024, you know, we should have moved into a better position. But in some regards, I don't think we have. David McCollum and I have talked about the fact that, for example, back in Victorian days, people kind of ate better, even the poor people ate sort of better than the highly processed food, absolute garbage, dangerous stuff that is the kind of the basics of modern diet, Peter. So you know, so like all of this fascinates me and our listeners because we all want to keep ourselves healthy. What would you say to people who charge their mobile phones beside their beds when they go to sleep at night?
I'd suggest doing downstairs or in another room as far away as possible. And it's not just what's happening with the mobile phone. There's always a risk of the thing catching fire. The one thing I've learned with a mobile phone, and this is where we start stepping over this, you know, day-to-day conversation to some of these darker realms. It is that although you can switch your phone off, it's never really switched off.
No,
you see, it's a receiver first and foremost. Now, just like you can get the remote control for your car and click it on and off, that car, you know, that remote control of that car is always there. There's something always happening. And it is fact that if somebody wanted to communicate with your mobile phone, assuming it had battery power and assuming it's switched off, there is a way you can still communicate with it.
Yeah. Scary.
There's still the ability for it to transmit. So that's the thing, that if you've got to charge a mobile phone, just charge it away from you. I'd say downstairs, but not everybody has two floors. Just charge it away from you. And that's what I would tend to suggest. Make sure it's switched off. You know, when you wake up in the morning, if you want to put it back on, just put it back on and go about your normal business. But anything like that, especially in the bedroom, keep away. You know, a small tip for the bedroom, if I may, outside of where we are. You know, air quality is something else. I built this to actually have a complete air filtration system in my property as well. You know, I've got the necessary water filters. I've got an air filtration system. You know, in the bedroom at night, if you want better air quality, go and buy an orchid. You know, an orchid will actually give off oxygen, even at night when there's no light. You know, all other plants, when it's dark, will give off carbon dioxide. An orchid will give out oxygen. So that, you know, put an orchid in your bedroom and switch your phone and Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's good.
You feel much better in the morning. There's a throwaway for you.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I see a comment from one of our listeners here. Ultron says, I stopped charging my phone in the bedroom, bring it up on screen, turning off Wi-Fi at night, and my quality of sleep has improved dramatically. So there you go, Peter.
I see.
Somebody's just doing what you said, but I like the orchid tip as well. I've never heard that before.
It's the simple thing. Well, I'm sure you're a bit of a traveler as well, David. If you go to places like Singapore, Malaysia, and the Far East, they'll all have orchids in the bedroom.
They do.
And no other flowers but orchids. And that's the main reason. An orchid will continue to take in whatever it needs to in the environment, but it will always give out oxygen. So it's a lovely plant to have in the bedroom. And again, the bedroom is our sanctuary. So if you've got your phone in there, take it out. If you've got Wi-Fi anywhere near your bedroom, get rid of it. You know, turn it off and treat your bedroom like your sanctuary. Even some of these diffusers to put a bit of humidity back in the air can be good in many circumstances. If you've got a diffuser with a built-in air filter, it even helps even more. But we touch, you know, touching into realms of, you know, looking after air quality. But with EMF, it's genuinely about the least exposure to it, the better. And it is as simple as our gentleman just said, switching off your Wi-Fi and don't charge your phone in the bedroom.
But I mean, that's a really fascinating tip that there, because it's dead simple to do. and yet... That from what our viewer is saying, it had a big impact on his quality of sleep, which is important, because it's all like one thing I've learned: everything in life it's all linked. Everything is connected. We need to be able to get good quality sleep, and I hear from people, you know, and they sit with their mobile phones, you know, permanently beside them 24/7, Peter. You know, they're permanently connected into their mobile phones. And guess what? They don't sleep that well. They're up in the middle of the night. They're on the phone in the middle of the night. And, you know, and I can't, and young people, some of the worst, well, people, as we said at the beginning of this, when we're young, we're all a wee bit stupid, you know, because we don't know, we haven't lived. But it would be far better not for them to have that 24-hour EMF exposure, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And it's just taking it away when you don't need it, when you don't need to use it, more importantly. And everybody these days, unfortunately, we've got a cocktail around us. That's not a very nice cocktail. You know, you're exposed to every form of food that's, you know, highly processed. You've got no nutrition in a lot of what we have in our diets. And when you look at, and this is probably where, and I shouldn't really dwell on this too much, but when you actually look at the immune systems that we have in general, and I exclude ourselves from this because hopefully we're a little bit more educated than some others, or aware, not educated, aware. I've got to be, education is only as good as the information you've received. And who's to say today's education is correct information?
Yeah, well, I would agree with that.
I mean, I've some classics on that. Yeah. So everyone has a compromised immune system because what they're being told to eat, what they're being told is good for them, is actually nutritiously, you know, void garbage. Yes. And then suddenly you introduce a cocktail of, you know, water that contains huge amounts of fluoride.
Yes, absolutely,
And then you've got these high EMFs that's being, you know, it's been, you know, being, it's everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
And your body is suddenly thinking, well, hey, hold on a minute, I don't stand a chance anymore. So, you know, your degeneration is going to happen a lot quicker. You're going to feel tired. You're going to feel lethargic. And you're going to go through life saying, doctor, please prescribe me some, you know, some sort of product that's going to keep me going for the next 40 years. And you know, I really seriously question what's happening out there. Why aren't people thinking for themselves? You know, everyone knows about nutrition, don't they? You
know, well, do they? I mean, do they? Do people know about nutrition? I would question that, and I don't think people. Again, we have to be careful with our words.
Yes,
some people do think. Again, going back to 2020, I'm very clear. There's two groups of people. We have critical thinkers who independently try to work it out. They mightn't get all the answers, but they think for themselves. And then, Peter, sadly, a majority group herd who just go with whatever, you know, the current thing is, whatever the box in the in the room tells them to do, you know. So it's, whether it's go and take your 16 COVID jabs to feel better, whatever it is, they will do what they are told. And so when you talk about, like, we're living in this sort of cocktail where the food's corrupted, water's not great. Well, water's definitely not great. And there was a down in Devon, they've got parasites and God knows what in the water. Thames Valley water, I think, which supplies, what's it? It's the biggest water supplier in the UK. I see they're on the edge of bankruptcy and stuff. So water's not great, food's not great, EMF's not great. I just wonder, putting it out there, I wonder, is that accidental? I wonder, is that all just a coincidence that it's all come together to make people feel like crap? So they then go and, as you say, go to the doctor, do whatever, go to the supermarket, but get more of the bad stuff because they think that's what they have to do. What do you think?
You know, the one thing you missed out of there is air quality. And there's a lot of things at the moment about, you know, whether they call them chemtrails. And having flown quite a bit, I do understand how some of the atmospherics work around, you know, condensation and wanting to do the chemicals. And I do know people that are part of that sector that will show you photographs of tanks with inside large aircraft where that's another subject for another day. But you're quite right. You know, we've got this whole cocktail around us. And one of the things I like to rattle people with, one little question I love to, and I keep saying this, and, you know, for listeners that may have heard me before, and one in particular that always hears me say this, I do apologise, but when anybody visits their GP, and it's, you know, let's hope they don't need to, but when they visit their GP, the GP will say to you, well, David, what's your problems? And you will say, well, you know, I have this, and I'm not feeling that great. And the doctor will say, okay, tap. Right, what you need to do is to take one of these twice a day for the next month.
That's right, yep.
And just as you're about to leave, you say, well, by the way, doctor, you know, I've been drinking diesel fuel and eating mud for the last 2 months. Do you think that's got anything to do with it?
Yeah.
So the good old GP never asks you what you've been doing for the last 1, 2, 3 months of your life to get into the condition that you are today. In general, if you've got a cut or a break, then obviously you've done that. But in general health, they never say, what is it you've been doing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, this has been one of the revelations in recent years, for some of us anyway, that where we thought that, I mean, basically I just see GPs by and large as an extension, they're salespeople for big pharma. That's all they are. That's the reality of it. Let's call a spade a spade. And they do exactly what you say, Peter. You know, people come in and what they're doing is they're treating the symptom, not the cause.
Correct.
And the causes, as you said, could be all the things we've been chatting about, we've been touching on, you know, those are the things, but those are the things that a GP will never really get into. They're sitting there, they're looking at their, you know, their watch. They've got 10 minutes to sort you out. That's it. And so they're never going to get to, this is why it comes back to, I think we all individually, everybody watching this, everyone listening to this, we have to be responsible, Peter, I feel, and take control of our own health, as indeed you did from what happened to you. No one else is going to do it for us. We have to do it, I feel. You know, and that's why listening to people like yourself, listening to people like David, it's very important, bit of background noise there.
My young girl being told to go to sleep.
So it is important that we get information out to people, and even you know, even if it is as simple, like someone's saying here with medicine, everyone has a side effect. It's a roller coaster of prescription chasing, using the next drug to combat the ill effect of the last. Well, that's true, isn't it? A lot of it is anyway. You know, we'll give you this drug. Oh, you've got a side effect. Here's a different drug for it. But inherently, a lot of the best stuff doesn't come out of a pill box, does it? It doesn't. It can be just eating the right stuff, you know, in the right amount, the right life. If you can exercise doing that, I mean, you know, these are the big things. One of the things that bothered me so much about COVID was they said, "Oh, right, terrible disease, terrible deadly virus, allegedly." And by the way, don't go out and exercise. Don't meet other human beings. I mean, if you were thinking up a recipe to damage humanity, that's what it looked like. I put it to you.
And you put it to me quite right, David, I will say. I totally accept and endorse what you've said. I really do. I mean, as part of my journey, let's go back to basics and absolute fundamentals. I'm a very simplistic guy. And when I started doing my research about, you know, preventing my body getting better,
yes.
I looked at the foods, I looked at supplements, I looked at nutrition, and as you know, my background is studying minerals, and I looked at the fact that the British government did a 40-year study about the mineral depletion in our soils from the mid-40s to the mid-80s,
yes.
and everyone can look at this, you can go online and Google it, it's called the McCants and Widdowson Report, actually initiated by the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Foods back in the early 40s, and the conclusion was in the mid-80s that, you know, we've got a huge decline in minerals in our soil, which means that, and they suggested that by the turn of the century, i.e. year 2000, would have chronic ill health throughout our society. And I go back to the very basics, the air that we breathe should be clean.
Yes.
The water we drink should be obviously clean. The food that we eat should be nutritionally rich, and it should grow out of the earth. And the one thing I've learned, very simple, very basic, that if those nutrients are not in the soil, how can they be in the food? They're not.
They can't.
Exactly. And that's where the thing, and what's missing with these little things called minerals. So the quality of the vitamins and all the other nutrients that grow within our crop is reliant on the minerals that are in the soil. So it's very basic. I say it's very basic stuff. But people, they haven't been told about it because, A, there's no fix for it, and B, where are you, you know, what are you going to do? You're not going to go and buy your packet of crisps or whatever it happens to be. But
See, this whole area, we don't have time to do it tonight, but we can maybe do it another night.
I'd be happy to join you again if your listeners would like me.
Yeah, we might bring our friend David in to join us for one, because I'm fascinated in the whole area of all what you've just talked about there in terms of the degradation of soil, something David McCullum and I talk about a lot as well. A lot of people don't totally understand that. They don't. And then a lot of people don't fully understand, Peter, the whole issue of like mineral supplements and vitamin supplements and what's clean and what's not. And all of that is a huge area. And again, I think that there's a lot of education to be done because people, you know, let me put it this way. So people think, oh, I can get all that I need. I just need to dip down to Tesco, pick up some supplements, go down into Holland and Barrett, get some of the good minerals and stuff. They don't know. They don't understand the deeper elements of the research that I know you've done. And I think it's a fascinating subject because, again, what we put in our mouth makes such a difference to us as people. And yet we're being corralled, don't you think, Peter, into stuff. Yeah, I mean, David McCullum says here, I can testify that Peter's plant-based minerals have made a tremendous difference to my health. Well, I have to say, Peter, I take them as well. So there's two of us, two recommendations. But there's thousands of people, tens of thousands of people potentially beyond that who need it explained properly. And we don't have time to do it tonight on this particular conversation. But I'd really like to get into the nitty-gritty on it because I think if people knew half of what you know, which is twice as much as I know, right, they would find it helpful, I think. Would you not agree?
I think, and that's all I've tried to do in my journey, literally, for about 23 years I've been involved in looking at preventative measures to help my body aging and falling to bits, basically. Yeah. You know, minerals has been the key part of that. And again, we won't go through that detail now. Very happy to join you and help your listeners further. Yeah. And it's so simplistic that when that penny drops, you know, your listeners certainly they'll be thinking and questioning, oh, okay, I do need to make that change. And I'll leave you with this because I appreciate we are pushed for time now. Yeah. During my work over these last two decades with minerals and the products that I've put together, and it's not about my products, I've seen miracles happen, and I won't say, you know, actually been superb things that have happened, all in different areas, to the point where I've had GPs write into the health service to say, investigate what this guy's doing, investigate what he's got in his products, because the results these patients are having are totally, I can't understand how. And on three occasions, I've had the authorities come to me, analyze what I'm doing, just in case that I'm not putting any, you know, unnecessary substances in them. Mm. All we've got is products from nature, not my products. I didn't design them. You know, for those people that, we go to church on Sunday, it's something that's God, you know, God has put here for us on this planet.
Yes.
And that's all I do. I'm just a messenger that takes something that's left for those that you know are in need. Tremendous.
Well, look, Peter, it's been fascinating talking to you. And we've really just, you know, we've got to the end of the show and we've only just started to explore a lot of the issues. But that's always a good sign, that, by the way. That's always a really good sign. So, you know, I mean, as I say, on this show, on this platform, you know, we are trying to get information out there. We're trying to counter a lot of the fake stuff that's put out by, you know, all the kind of the establishment cabal, who essentially, I think, are happy poisoning people. I mean, I think they're very happy to do that. We're trying to counter that in our own ways, in different regards. So I would love it if we can come back. If you can come back, Peter, and David McCullum, you're watching, maybe we can set up and the three of us can come back at another time and specifically get into the issues like soil degradation, all that stuff, Peter, and, you know, and then the minerals and the plant-based, all that stuff. I think that would be a fascinating show. David McCullum has confirmed he is up for that. Right, you're on, young
I'm
man.
I'm sure he is. I'm sure he is. Anything that your audience would love to hear, certainly from my side, I'll be only too happy to impart that knowledge and information.
Yeah, well, look, I really appreciate the conversation we've had tonight. It's been fascinating. I mean, your own backstory is amazing and fascinating to me. The whole sort of the whole EMF and all of that stuff and the radio frequency stuff, this toxic cocktail that surrounds us. It's good people know about these things. And I like your two tips, which I think everyone should do. Basically, make sure you turn off your Wi-Fi router or your phone in your bedroom, charge it up downstairs. And I'll be doing this tomorrow. Go and buy an orchid and put it in your bedroom, because that seems to be really simple health thing to get that. If you get a good night's sleep, Peter, it makes all the difference to your next day, doesn't it? Do you know?
Absolutely. I mean, totally and absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. It means I like to start the day buzzy, full of energy. You know, anything that distracts me from being full on to start the day is to be avoided. And that we've got a few tips from you. Peter Willoughby, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, folks, wherever you've been watching or listening to this one. And thank you, David McCollum, for the kind comments. And thanks, everybody, again. Podcasts are all back on stream again. By the way, do check out Daily Podcasts and my Substack. I want to thank everyone. Just before we go, quick one here, Peter. I put out an article on Doctor Who. Who knew, if you'll pardon the pun, that it kind of went ballistic. I think it's got 300,000 views or something over in the Twitters, because I was questioning the woke Doctor Who. So for all of those of you who read that, thanks very much. It wasn't a big thing, but it's funny, Peter, what people latch onto and what people go with. But again, we're trying to fight in a culture war. We're fighting at different levels, so we're doing our very best. Peter, thanks so much for giving us your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Appreciate that. Thanks, everybody. See you real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.